is a story, perhaps not too surprisingly, after you hear the title, about how to be a good friend. It's called A Little Help from My Friends. My mate Keith was looking for a way out. He rang me at 3 a.m. wanting to know about cliffs in general and Beachy Head in particular. I got his drift immediately and felt quite flattered that he contacted me for advice. My feeling was that Beachy Head's a bit obvious, which is how I came up with the Pembrokeshire plan. It's miles from anywhere. There's so much cliff path and so few walkers. Even fewer now in February, when the days are short. I used to go there on holidays as a kid. It always rained, and we always spent the whole time digging. Beaches, river banks, general mud by the side of the road. We thought we'd find treasure, secrets, the key to something. But I only remember burying my prize red spade and not being able to uncover it again. Well, now Keith got in the car and headed for Haverford West. But being a tight bastard always was, he only put enough petrol in to get to the county town, not realising that this is some considerable distance from the actual coast. So he wrote himself a little cardboard sign, like he must have seen the hippie boys and girls do. Not that he's ever stopped for one of them. Nothing if not honest, Keith, which is why he set off on this journey to start with. So he put, imminent suicide, swift, uncomplicated lift required to coast or near. Now, as you or I or any normal person would understand straight away, unless you've got a banner as big as yourself, getting all that on a bit of card 20 inches by 10 is a tall order. Keith, to his credit, managed it. But unless Superman with his X-ray vision was driving by on the Haven Road, no one had a hope of reading what he'd put. So apparently there was this thing going on where the drivers, even those little white-haired old ladies in their identikit beige three-quarter coats, slowed right down to see what the sign said. They had to just about stop before they could read it. As a consequence, everyone from the old ladies in their little two-door wheelchairs with roofs to some stubbly-skinned boyo in his souped-up tin can on the way to teach PE to fat 11-year-olds practically came to a standstill. Then, when they got the gist, they'd stamp on the accelerator and pull out so wide round him that oncoming traffic had to mount the pavement, which must have been their biggest thrill since pushing their juicy way into the world. Fair play to Keith, he was being nothing if not bloody minded, so he started walking in what he took to be the direction of the sea due to the amount of wind blowing off it. For city boys like Keith, weather in general causes no end of grief, but this must have been especially fucking tedious, as in anticipation of his demise, he'd skipped his last barber's appointment. He hadn't wanted to squander the cash or torture himself over whether to leave one last tip. Consequently, as he walked, his fringe flipped itself under his eyelashes and away again, getting more and more irritating, like being slapped in the eyes with a paintbrush. And of course, he wasn't dressed for the seaside. Down there, the cliff paths have puddles the size of the Irish Sea, water pouring everywhere, like the whole country's leaking. So he was soon in mud to the ankles, like the earth didn't want to let him go, or was determined to reclaim him, depending on your state of mind. I got a call from Keith just before he started walking. The reception was rubbish, but what he said made me worry a bit that I'd given him a bum steer. He wasn't sure he was going in the right direction, and I suddenly wondered whether you don't want to be a bit closer to home if you're going to do the deed. And for the first time, I was a bit concerned that he should be doing it at all. I've no problem with rational decision making. Our lives are our own, and I quite like the idea of cheating death by choosing your own place and time. And Keith did too, I know, because we talked about it down the pub. Hypothetically, you know, and not unless we'd had a few beers, because as we've established, Keith wasn't one for idle chit-chat. But it suddenly struck me that there might be more for Keith, and that maybe he wanted more from life than he thought he did. Maybe, in fact, he wanted so much he thought it was impossible. But this is just conjecture. At the end of the day, all you've got to go on is the facts. And the most important thing a mate can do is help a friend out. So, I told him to take the third right off the Haven Road and eventually he'd hit the sea. He said, okay, fine, back on track now, and then the phone line packed up. You go down country lanes with spiky hedgerows, all thorns just now, but stuffed with flowers and birds in the summertime. And then there are a few bungalows. After that, a miserable looking pub. And then the road drops down and turns rolling along the water's edge, scraping along wet black sand and cannonball pebbles before wheeling away up the hill. I imagine Keith stopping here. He looks out to sea. The beach has two great cliff arms that stretch round in a semicircle, like they want to touch each other but they can't reach. They're very big and very black, and Keith wonders how the hell he's supposed to scale them in his trainers. I bet he thought the road would take him to the top of the cliff, which would have made the next step reasonably straightforward. And which side up? Not another decision. He would have promised himself he didn't have to make any more. It's getting dark down below, like the cliffs are eating up the light. Eventually he notices the steps at the foot of the cliff to his left, and I see him heading up and up, leaving a lot of the darkness behind. On top it's still daylight and the view is fantastic, and the clouds look like mermaid's hair all combed out, and the perfect curve of the cove below in the last of the sunset is streaky like a seashell. But Keith can't stop because, you see, his mind's made up. When Sarah left him, because she never could get an answer out of him right down to the last, do you want me here or not, Keith said he decided that was it. The cat could fend for itself. He really needed to remove the obligation to hold a conversation with anyone. Because it was never conversation he seemed to get, but interrogation. What do you do? Where are you from? What did you do last night? And mostly he hadn't done anything or been anywhere. He'd just been being alive, painting, decorating, buying baked beans and sausages and eating them in front of the television at night. He had no aspiration to do anything more, but everyone seemed to expect him to. And Sarah, especially Sarah. In the beginning, they'd eaten their baked beans together, but then Sarah got bored and the questioning began. When are we going to get a bigger house? Where should we go on holiday? Why don't you get a new job? Can't you get some new clothes? And you could see she got more and more bored when he didn't say anything. But to be fair, what was he supposed to say? By the time he'd thought of an answer to the first, which was something like, we don't really need a bigger house because this one has three bedrooms and there's just us and we share the same one, she'd already asked several supplementaries. One night he told me Sarah had stopped laughing at the stuff he liked on TV, so now he had to pretend he wasn't laughing or hold a cushion over his stomach and push his face into the top of it so that any kamikaze laughter got sucked up before it made a noise. When he'd had a lot more beers, he told me he'd taken to keeping pornography in an old chocolate box on the top of the wardrobe. Sarah never mentioned it, but once he'd pulled the box down and someone had written "fuckwit" on the top in dust. When she left, he didn't seem that surprised, and none of his mates were. He looked like he was getting on with it. I saw him once a month or so at football or whatever. And then I heard his mum had died. I meant to ring him up, but the time never seemed quite right, and I got this brilliant new PlayStation, and my God, it's fantastic. You can sit down, and the next thing you know, it's 3 a.m. And who wants to get rung up at 3 a.m? So I can see him up there, on the cliff top, and I've got to admit, it's getting tough now. But he's made up his mind. All he has to do is execute his plan, and that just means sticking one foot in front of the other, which is all he's been doing for years. One, two, one, two. One. But there's a bit of a delay. Maybe something feels wrong, like he's crossing the traffic somehow. People go from left to right or right to left along the cliff path, not straight out. He stands on one leg for a minute, then puts the other back down. The sea looks like a million mussel shells open like hungry mouths. Keith can't stop. He looks down. There's a little clearing in the bracken, a short pathway made by a sheep. He points himself at it. The cliffs are running with ink. The rocks look like black leather nails. Keith has no choice. He's made up his mind. He inhales and feels the cold wetness inside of himself and outside. He takes a run at the little sheep pathway, and after 3 paces, there's nothing beneath his feet. He's flying and dropping and flying and dropping. And what if this is when he changes his mind? If this is when he thinks, bugger me, Stan, you could have stopped me. You could have told me I didn't have to do it just because I decided to. You could have helped me find something that made me want to stay alive. So, here's another version. Where I come blasting down the M4 in the van, breaking all land speed records. Scream off the motorway at Haverford West. Pull over so fast when I see Keith that he gets chucked into a ditch and breaks his legs. where he ends up spending 6 months in the general ward of Withybush Hospital, where I make him do some real thinking and proper talking that gets somewhere. And even when he's certain he's run out, more and more new thoughts just keep on coming.